Kickstarting the programme, I went in search of answers about Parkinson's disease. First up, I wanted to get some idea of how many people it affects and how.
Yes, hello. Well, I'm James Roy. I'm a consultant neurologist at Addenbrookes Hospital, and I work with the Cambridge University on some of the research studies in Parkinson's disease and related disorders. Well, Parkinson's is a fantastically diverse and challenging illness, not just because it affects up to 100,000 people in the UK, but because of the range of problems it can cause. Many people will be familiar with the idea that it causes a tremor and slowness and stiffness, but perhaps not everyone will be aware it causes many other problems, what we call non-motor symptoms. These include sleep problems, these affecting mood of anxiety and depression, pain even, and many other problems. Even constipation is remarkably common too. So a wide range of symptoms. Many people, even quite early in the illness, have difficulty with thinking flexibly or planning ahead and multitasking in their mind. This is distinct from what can happen later on in the illness, which is some patients can go on to get a dementia. So two very different sorts of thinking or memory problems, but both very challenging.
And do we know much about what's going on in the brain in order to give rise to these very complex and wide-ranging symptoms associated with Parkinson's?
Well, it's been known for many years that a key chemical in the brain called dopamine is lacking. The cells that make dopamine appear to die back early in Parkinson's disease. In fact, by the time that somebody presents to their doctor with Parkinson's disease, you may already have lost 70, 80 or even 90% of the dopamine cells. So the mainstay of treatment for the last 45 years has been dopamine drugs, either to mimic dopamine or help your body boost the amount of dopamine it can make.
So this highly prevalent disorder, most famously now affecting Michael J. Fox, is known to have a biological cause, this dying off of the dopamine nerve cells. We can treat it by giving patients L-DOPA or similar to replace some of the lacking chemical messenger dopamine and alleviating some of the symptoms. But in the main, this only helps mask the symptoms for a short amount of time. Researchers are hoping to improve available treatments by coming up with clever new techniques to gain a much better understanding of the disorder. I visited Oxford to find out more.
My name is Richard Wade-Martins. I'm a lecturer here at the University of Oxford, and I also head the recently formed Oxford Parkinson's Disease Centre. The critical thing that we really don't understand about Parkinson's is, of all the billions of neurons that are present in your brain, why is it those that make dopamine that die off? It's one of the major unanswered questions in the disease, and one of the things we're focusing here in my laboratory. What we're able to do now for the first time is actually make neurons in the laboratory from patients and from controls. Now, how do we do that? You can't drill a hole in somebody's head and take out some neurons to grow the dish. People want to keep hold of their neurons. They're too precious. So what we can do instead is to use new technologies of stem cells. So what we've been able to do in the centre is to take a skin biopsy from an individual, either a Parkinson's patient or a control. Take that skin biopsy using a hole punch. It's about the same size as a hole you might punch out in a piece of A4 paper. So you take that skin punch, take that back to the laboratory, chop it up into little bits and let those bits of skin fall down to the bottom of your dish. And you put a growth medium on top of there, sort of liquid that contains all the things that cells need to be happy and grow. And a type of cell called a fibroblast will start to grow out from the skin culture. So after about 2 or 3 weeks, the cells have grown out from your skin sample, and you now have a culture of growing cells from either a patient or a control. What you then do is you can use various genetic tricks, if you like. You can add to these fibroblasts a number of different cellular reprogramming factors, we call them, that are able to turn back the clock, if you like, on these fibroblasts. You're able to genetically persuade the fibroblasts that they're not skin cells anymore, but they're stem cells. And these cells will now grow in your dish as stem cells. They're called induced pluripotent stem cells. They're induced because you've turned them into stem cells, and they're pluripotent. They will go on to become any cell type you like. So once you've got stem cells from your patients, you can now turn them into a cell type that you wish to study. So if we were interested, for example, in cardiovascular disease, we'd turn them into cells of the heart and study that. So what we do in the lab, we're interested in dopamine neurons, how they work and how they die. So we turn these stem cells into dopamine neurons.
So this exciting new technology of turning skin cells into dopamine nerve cells provides a method by which to investigate how the cells of patients with Parkinson's differ to other people's, and why they are more susceptible to dying in the first place. The idea being that once you understand how these cells die in the dish, you can first of all screen for new molecules that may help them survive and put us on the road to developing, for the first time, therapies in Parkinson's that can stop the cells dying rather than just supplement the dopamine that's already lost. Richard explains how they're using this technique in the lab to do this.
So the dopamine neurons in an individual and even in a patient will work quite happily for 30, 40 or 50 years and then they'll start dying. My PhD students and postdocs don't want to work in the lab growing these neurons for 50 years, so we have to try and understand what might be changing much earlier. So when dopamine neurons die in a patient, they accumulate aggregates, gluggy bits of proteins, if you like, called Lewy bodies. And these Lewy bodies form as the neurons die over decades. We're not working on that time scale, so we have to better understand what are the very earliest changes that may occur in these neurons to give us the first clue as to how they're starting to function differently. And we're starting to understand and investigate aspects of neuron biology that may be different in patients rather than controls. So there's various things we could study. We can study how they make dopamine, how they release dopamine. We can study other aspects of cell biology that's important for neurons. So for example, neurons don't divide. Neurons have to very tightly regulate the material in their cell and to recycle it and reuse it. And so we're starting to investigate differences that may occur in these neurons from a Parkinson's patient that mean they're not as able to recycle and reuse their cellular components as well as a healthy neuron might. Another difference that may be is in the way the neurons make and generate and supply energy. So there's a type of component of a cell called a mitochondria that's the energy factory. It makes energy. And there's been a suspicion for a long time that the mitochondria of Parkinson's patient just might not be quite as good. So we're starting to study a whole range of aspects of neuron biology in patients and control cell lines to better understand why those neurons die. And only when you understand how they die can you think how you might protect them.
So these skin cells that have been turned into nerve cells, could they be used to help identify people who are at high risk of developing Parkinson's decades down the line?
So that's a great idea. So the exciting aspect about these stem cells and the neurons that you make is that they are unique to the patient that you've made them from. So yes, we would be able to try and correlate perhaps proteins secreted from these neurons and how that might be different proteins secreted from a patient neuron compared to a control neuron.
And to next find out what somebody affected by the disorder actually thinks of this research, I took to the phone.
My name's Alan Cameron, and I was diagnosed with Parkinson's in late 2004, so I've been living with the condition for around 8 years now. The kind of thing you've described sounds extremely hopeful, because it sounds like something that's practical, that's within reach, that is perhaps heading towards a cure or meaningful protective effects to slow down the underlying progress of the condition.
I also wanted to know more about the symptoms of the disorder and how it's affected Alan so far.
Parkinson's is first and foremost known as a movement disorder, and the symptoms that I've experienced are primarily a loss of dexterity, which has been an issue for my job because I spend a lot of time typing. As well as a movement disorder, it commonly brings depression, and I've experienced that also, and in many ways that's been a bigger part of the impact of my work than the movement disorder itself. And it's well known that it's currently incurable, and it's a progressive condition. With medication we can address some of the symptoms, but we don't address the underlying progress of the condition. I'm lucky in that for me, the progression has been quite slow. Parkinson's is known as a kind of designer disease. It affects different people very differently. Drugs are available which are very effective at addressing the symptoms. So what you will tend to find is you'll ramp up the drugs slowly over time. But you do slowly, day by day, start to notice that different things become more difficult. My dexterity is primarily affected on the left side, so changing gear or getting my arm into a sleeve is sometimes difficult. And I've tended to avoid shirts with cufflinks because they can become just a little bit too much fun.
In order to find out more about these mood symptoms and the progression of Parkinson's disease, I returned to speak with neurologist Dr. James Rowe from Cambridge University.
Yes, well, depression and the other mood problem of anxiety are extremely common with Parkinson's disease. There's a lot of questions that are unanswered. The first is it more common than you would expect in people of a similar age? Is the depression a reaction in some people against having what is essentially bad news? Is it a reaction to having a restriction on your lifestyle and your expectations of a happy and active retirement? Or could it be something more, that the illness itself is leading to depression? One of the challenges we face is that it's not clear whether the usual approaches to treatment of depression that you might take in younger adults without Parkinson's disease, whether they work as well in patients with Parkinson's disease.
And can you tell us a little bit about the research that's going on here in Cambridge in the area of Parkinson's?
So that we have a very active research clinic here, recruiting patients really from Cambridgeshire and surrounding counties. And it covers a very diverse range of projects. One of them is to really try and understand what the very first symptoms of Parkinson's disease are and how it first affects the brain, really within months of your symptoms coming on. On that basis, we also want to try and understand what predicts how your Parkinson's disease will evolve. Will you be someone who lives with it, with a nuisance from your Parkinson's disease, remaining fully active and independent over 10 or 15 years? Or will you be someone who'll get an early and aggressive dementia, perhaps over the first couple of years? Both of these things can happen. What we don't yet understand is predicting and understanding why one individual takes one route or the other. So a lot of research onto that. That's linked to work on both treating some of the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, and our emphasis is on treating the thinking and memory problems that can come with Parkinson's disease, what we call cognition or enhancing cognition. The other aspect is looking at treatments that might alter the course of the illness itself, fundamentally alter the course of the illness. What's increasingly clear, and the focus for our research, is the other chemicals in the brain that can be affected by Parkinson's disease. So two in particular we focus on, one called serotonin, that people might have heard of in connection with depression and mood or anxiety. The other chemical is noradrenaline, a brain's version of adrenaline, that's also very important for clear thinking and flexibility.
Alan has been involved in a number of such studies as a volunteer. I asked him more about the experience. Was it empowering?
I think it's recognised as a kind of therapeutic effect of volunteering. It gives you some way of feeling that you can take the fight to the condition rather than just sit and spectate on an inevitable decline.
So, how does one go about volunteering for such research studies? I called up the Director of Research and Innovation at the charity Parkinson's UK.
My name is Dr. Kieran Breen. There are a number of ways in which this can be done. One of these is by taking part in a clinical trial. This could be, for example, testing out a new drug to see if it's better than an existing drug. Or it could be using some other sort of treatment, such as physiotherapy or other sorts of therapies that don't involve the use of medicines. And another way in which we are encouraging people to get involved is by forming partnership with researchers. When a researcher wants to carry out a trial that will ultimately help people with Parkinson's, it's important that they get the views of the people who have the condition at an early stage. We want to make sure that at the end of the piece of research, that the findings will actually be meaningful for somebody affected by the condition.
And in terms of people with Parkinson's volunteering for these different types of studies, how long should they expect to be donating their time for this type of activity?
This may involve 1 hour per month. It may involve 1 hour per day. There are many different types of projects and there are many different ways in which people can get involved. And what we want to be able to do is to provide people with a wide variety of different areas of research and different ways in which you can get involved in research. And then you can make a decision as to how or if you want to get involved according to what is required and according to the time that you have available.
That was Dr. Kieran Breen from Parkinson's UK. And before that, I spoke with Alan about his condition, in addition to Dr. James Rowe and Dr. Richard Wade Martin about their research at Cambridge and Oxford universities, respectively. Next, we'll be finding out if it's true that we only use 10% of our brains. But first,